At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Welcome to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, here with Kentucky Speaker of the House, David Osborne, who's going to give us a legislative update. Welcome, David.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Hey, I really appreciate your time with us. You are in a very busy time of the year. The 2022 legislature convenes tomorrow, and you've got a lot going on, don't you?
It is very few dull moments right now.
It's always
a scramble before session. It's always you left with a little bit of that feeling of, I don't know how in the world we're going to get ready for it. But then we always do it, and we move on.
Welcome back to the Commonwealth Matters, and apologize for that technical difficulty we just had. We are back with Kentucky Speaker of the House, David Osborne. And David, as you were speaking and as I was not able to hear, we were talking about the biennial budget. And because Kentucky, if I understood you correctly, because we have a better financial picture of where Kentucky is, we are going to be able to pass a two-year budget this year, correct?
We will pass a two-year budget, yes. We still have a lot of uncertainty in the economy, a lot of uncertainty with what the long-term impact of our is going to be on our revenues. But I do think that we have enough information to pass a two-year budget.
David, what are the chances of doing tax modernization? The legislature a couple years ago took steps to move away from the state income tax and towards a consumption-based tax. Will there be more efforts in that area?
Richard, I am notorious for saying that the worst time in the world to do tax reform is at the same time you're doing a budget. I believe that they are competing interests, both extremely important, but raising money and spending money at the same time are not necessarily a hand-in-hand endeavor. I think that it distorts what is maybe the best tax policy to develop. That said, I do believe that because we have record revenues, record surplus, record budget reserve trust fund, I do believe that it gives us perhaps a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to truly do comprehensive tax reform. Because of that, I do believe that you will see us moving the ball on tax reform, and I expect us to be very aggressive with it. I think that is also one of the reasons you're going to see us be very aggressive from a time standpoint on the budget. I think that you will see us move the budget quicker than perhaps you have in the past to eliminate that talking about both issues at the same time. If we can get the budget out of the House, get it down to the Senate, so we're not focused on how much money we have to spend, then I think it gives us the freedom to have a broader conversation about tax reform.
One important issue regarding the budget and where some of that stimulus, I want to go back to that. $1.1 billion budget surplus from last fiscal year. We're expecting another over $1 billion from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. Will any of this money be allocated towards the state pension system?
Not direct. Well, I'm going to answer that kind of two different ways, Richard. The federal monies that came down actually had a prohibition against using those for any pension deficits. So we can't directly appropriate federal monies for that. However, the surplus that we have, the monies that we have in the Budget Reserve Trust Fund, certainly those monies can be appropriated. I think that you will continue, just as you've seen the last three budgets that we've passed, you've seen us fully fund the pension system at over twice the legal requirement. I think you will continue to see us make that commitment and quite possibly even more than you've seen us do in the past.
Very good. Redistricting, and I know our time is limited, but the House did release a map of new legislative districts because Eastern Kentucky and West Kentucky has lost population. Louisville has increased. Lexington has increased. It's going to pit at least four Republican incumbents. Well, it puts them in the same districts, and also four Democratic incumbents in the same districts. I'm sure you're hearing a lot from the folks across the state. It's a very difficult endeavor to redistrict and to put together fair maps. Do you expect this to pass? And then I guess the second part, and maybe the most important part, is it going to be challenged in court?
I can't answer the legal side of it, Richard. That's something that I can't possibly predict. I will tell you that I am 100% confident that we complied with every legal and constitutional consideration. We made a pledge from day one that we were going to do that. This is the first time in history that we've ever gotten to draw a map. And maybe 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the road, a Republican majority drawing maps is not going to be an oddity. But I will tell you that we made the commitment early on that we only get one chance to do it the first time, and we're going to do it right. And I am confident in the map. I'm proud of the map. Redistricting is an incredibly difficult process. I never had, quite frankly, a full appreciation for just how difficult it is. And I think the public at large sees it, obviously, as a largely political interest. And it's really not. I mean, certainly there's some politics that comes into it, but at the end of the day, this is a very mathematical and legal form. I can't tell you the number of calls that I've gotten just over the weekend of people saying, well, why didn't you put, County A with County B instead of with County C? And the fact of the matter is, the population requirements won't allow it in many cases. The division of counties wouldn't allow it. When you look at all of the legal and constitutional provisions, it's very, very difficult to put together a tremendous amount of options.
Yeah, very good. School choice. I know we're moving quickly here, but school choice is a hot issue. 86% of Kentuckians, according to one survey, favor some form of school choice. Do you expect school choice legislation to come forward this year or be considered in the Kentucky House?
I do expect to see additional school choice legislation, Richard. I'm not 100% sure what it will look like at this point. There are several different bills that are floating around out there. We're still waiting on some court decisions on what we passed last year. So we're going to kind of work around some of those outstanding issues. I think that you saw a caucus that was firmly committed to offering additional opportunities for kids across the state, and that commitment has continued. And I think that you will see us continue to advance that cause, as well as, quite frankly, doing additional things that we can to improve the quality of public education. At the end of the day, I think that we will all acknowledge that public education will still be the cornerstone for what educates the vast majority of kids in Kentucky. And so, yes, we want to give additional choice opportunities to as many as possible, but we also want to do everything that we can to improve the overall quality of public education.
Very good. Last issue, David, is the omnibus abortion bill. State Representative Nancy Tate introduced a bill that would make it more difficult for minors to get an abortion, put restrictions on disposing fetal tissue, and create more restrictions for abortion medication. You have a pro-life majority. 75 out of 100 members are Republican. Most identify as pro-life. Do you see this issue moving fairly quickly, moving through the Kentucky House?
Richard, I think that by any objective view, this has been one of the most pro-life legislatures over the last 4 years anywhere in the country. I see nothing that will change that commitment to the protection of life. And I can't get into specifics on the omnibus bill just because, quite frankly, we've not talked about all the specifics in total, but I think that clearly we are committed to doing anything and everything that we can possibly do to protect life in the Commonwealth.
Speaker of the House, David Osborne, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work. God bless you, and take care. Happy New Year.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. It's clear that the news media isn't always fair. In fact, there's lots of far-left bias and political gamesmanship. No surprise there. So if you're looking for a perspective that's grounded in the truth of Scripture and our nation's founding principles, then get plugged into CPC's resources. Sign up for our e-newsletter at commonwealthpolicycenter.org. You can also follow us on Facebook at Commonwealth Policy Center. And we're on Twitter at CPC4Kentucky.
Welcome back to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. And joining us on this program is special guest, State Senator Robbie Mills. He is the chairman of the State Senate State and Local Government Committee in the State Senate. Great. Robbie, thank you for joining us.
Yep. Glad to be here.
You have had a busy week. You have been in the news. Your committee's been in the news. The legislature really has, because right. One of the most significant things that the legislature does every 10 years is they take the new census information and they configure new districts. The right. House comes up with their plan. The Senate right. comes up with their plan. Right. And of course, as you can imagine, when there are new districts configured, there's controversy and not everybody's going to be happy with that.
Yeah.
The reality is that Kentucky has not grown as quickly as other states.
Great.
The east part of the state has lost population. The west part of the state, where we're both from, have lost population. In fact, I looked at the different, there are 38 Senate districts, and the vast majority of each of those districts have lost population.
They have, yep.
The only growth has been in
central and northern Kentucky. Yep. So through the Lexington area, through northern Kentucky. Substantial amount of growth. Our population looks like it grew about a little over 100,000 over the last 10 years. So we have 4.5 million people in Kentucky.
Tell us a little bit about the redistricting process, because this is one of those issues when you talk politics and talk redistricting, there's a lot of misinformation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of speculation. Tell us just a overview of what's involved with that.
Right. I mean, it's really a big math problem, to be honest with you. And you have to have your population before you can start the math problem. And that was one of our biggest challenges is when we would get the census data. We got the census data somewhere in September, October. We have software, the state has software that manipulates this data. And so from September, October, Senate members, Senate staff, leadership, in both the Senate and the House have been working on these numbers and trying to see, you know, what has changed in these districts. And, our biggest concern was really equally distributing population as much as we can in our situation on the 38 seats in the Senate. So the Senate, we kind of concentrated on the Senate maps and the congressional maps, and the House concentrated on the House maps. And so we had, both bodies were working on this population question, and we had some constitutional regards that we had to look after. The biggest constitutional that we had is really just, contiguous, and that districts had to be contiguous. So if we had three districts or three counties in a district, they had to touch each other. They had to be contiguous. And then also, that they're near as nearly as possible equal as we could. Mm-hmm. In the House and the Senate, the Supreme Court had actually ruled in two different rulings over the last 15 to 20 years that near equal was interpreted as meaning plus or minus 5%. Mm-hmm. So plus or minus 5%, our number we were shooting for in the Senate was 118,000 citizens in each Senate district. And then it could vary 5% below or 5% above. So in the midst of everything, after we finished everything, all of our districts were plus or minus 5%. Even in the House, their districts were plus or minus 5%.
So that was one of the legal requirements to keep the populations equal per district in both House and Senate maps, also keeping the geographical integrity of the districts intact. There are some other provisions, too. There's a concern with minority voters being represented in the districts.
Right.
So you have a lot of considerations when you put together these new maps, don't
right.
you?
You do. And, you know, but our biggest concern was meeting our constitutional requirements, federal constitution, state constitution. We met those. And then, of course, you have, you know, outside groups that like to opine about all the kind of minor issues. But you know, we feel like that our Senate maps are the best that we've produced, you know, since we've been in the majority.
So Senator Mills, one of those outside groups that follows this issue of redistricting very closely is the Kentucky League of Women Voters.
Right.
And Susan Perkins Weston was quoted in the Courier-Journal commenting on the maps. She was on their redistricting committee. And she said that these maps, referring to the House and Senate, were clearly built to protect incumbents, and that leads to some substantial slicing up of our middle-sized counties. Now, she was referring to Laurel County, mm-hmm. The ones that are too large to be districted by themselves. How do you respond to, was that, now this is a charge that you hear not just from
right.
her, but from others.
Right, right.
What do you, but the incumbent protection
yeah,
side
I
of
mean,
things.
we did not pit in the Senate maps, we did not pit an incumbent against an incumbent. In the House, they did pit four different pairs against each other, two in Jefferson County, one in Western Kentucky, one in Eastern Kentucky. They pitted incumbents together. they almost had to because their districts were smaller than our districts. They're dealing with 45, 46,000 versus the 118 that we are. But, you know, they... You know, the League of Women Voters have always wanted input in the redistricting process. We gave them time at each one of our committee hearings mm-hmm. to come and talk, and they submitted written documents. They produced plans. They submitted the plans to Senate and the House. So, you know, we looked at their plans, but ultimately the Constitution just, you know, gives the legislature the authority to do redistricting. Nobody else. It's a purely legislative authority, and we take that very serious. And, you know, it's interesting in the legislative situation, the minority is always wanting more input when they're in mm-hmm, the minority,
mm-hmm.
but when they switch around and become in the majority, then they all of a sudden want to follow the Constitution. So that's the normal push and pull that we have in the legislative process. But you know, we feel like that we gave input, a proper amount of input from organizations like the League of Women Voters. And we also gave in the Senate the minority party, the Democratic Party, substantial input in the areas in Jefferson County.
Governor Andy Beshear had said that he was willing to call a special session, if I heard correctly,
right.
but he wanted to see the maps that you
right.
and House leaders had drawn as well. Of course, you did not share that with him, but the charge is that you did not work with the governor on this. Is that a fair charge?
Not really, to be honest with you. I mean, we have three arms of government, three stools of government, and there's always this push and pull that mm-hmm. one part of government wants a little bit more power than the other part.
Mm-hmm.
And we see our legislative duties as in redistricting as ours solely.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we didn't feel like that we needed to share our maps with the governor. We felt like that it's his duty when he sees a need for legislation to call us into special session. He would not call us into special session unless we gave him the maps and he could see them before we went into special session. Of course, there's a constitutional amendment on the ballot next year that will solve that, where the legislature can call itself into special session to deal with situations like this. So if we would have had a special session, we wouldn't have had all the rushing in the first week.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have had to extend the filing deadline for 2.5 or 3 weeks and cause confusion in our counties and our local elections. So there, you know, we see positives in having that special session. The governor just chose not to call us in. And in that situation, we just had to wait till last week to quickly pass these items.
Very good. If you're just joining us, State Senator Robbie Mills from Henderson is joining us, and he's giving us a legislative update. Robbie, we just talked about redistricting. There are two other bills I'd like us to spend the remaining amount of our time on, and you actually have them in your hand. You brought them over. One is called the SAFE Act. It is the Save Adolescents from Experimentation. A couple other states have passed this. Arkansas, I think Tennessee, maybe another one. But essentially it says that minors cannot have hormone therapy or gender transition surgery until they're 18. What's the need for this in Kentucky? Is this something that's happening right now where there are minors in the Commonwealth that are faced with this?
Yeah, you know, Richard, unfortunately, gender transitioning is really more of a fad. Mm-hmm. It's things that the liberal groups are talking about, and we see parents actually encouraging their children to go through this transitioning phase, mm-hmm. and even to the point of, you know, whether it's a nudge from the parents or a push mm-hmm. from the parents. And what this bill is really about is to protect the children and mm-hmm. Protect their innocence and protect their bodies from harm until they're 18 and they can decide how they want to live their lives and what they want to do with their bodies.
What would be the arguments, and you've been and heard the arguments on both sides, but what would be the most challenging arguments, I should say, against a bill like this? Yeah. Why would somebody want to allow a minor 14, 15, 16-year-old to transition to the other gender?
It's, you know, this is the LGBTQ issue in general is a very emotional issue. And so mm-hmm. many, mm-hmm. so many people have connections to someone who is struggling with emotional and behavioral issues, their identity, who they are. And everybody has a personal connection. And I think that's the most challenging mm-hmm. part of a piece of legislation like this. It's very obvious to me that, you know, allowing someone to mutilate genitalia and do things that you cannot recover from easily mm-hmm. is a form of child abuse. Mm-hmm. But yet you have the emotional connection of, I just want my child to be right, to feel right, to fit in. And those are the issues that you have to overcome in the legislation and talking to constituents. It's a prickly subject, for sure.
It is. Real people are involved. There are people, young children, who are struggling with their identity, and some people are convinced that they would be better off identifying as the opposite gender, opposite sex. I've known you long enough to know that you don't intend to harm anybody. You don't want to demean anybody, and I know that personally. I know I've known you well as a friend. So full disclosure, Bobby's been a friend. At the same time, and the reason I'm asking the tough questions or challenges to this is because you hit the nail on the head. There are family relationships. There are people you care for, and you know, parents care about their kids and they want to support their kids. Right. At the same time, Robbie, parents and their wishes can't overrule what is best for that children. Here's what I mean. Children can't drive until they're age 16.
Right.
They can't vote until they're 18. They can't drink alcohol till they're 21. And these are public policies that we've agreed on as being good for the safety of children and for the good of society. Would you see the SAFE Act falling in the same lines?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons why we don't let kids drive until they're 16, they make rash decisions, quick decisions, you know, mm-hmm. improper, unsafe decisions mm-hmm. when they're driving. So similar to this, a fad, something that a teacher or a other fellow student has talked to them about, and all of a sudden they want to make this big change.
Yeah.
It's we're protecting the children until they get mature enough to make good, solid decisions. We're also protecting the children from their parents who might be misinformed and might want to put this on them. And in my opinion, I see it as an abusive situation.
Very good. One last bill I'd like to discuss, and it's something you're going to introduce as well, the Save Women's Sports Act, which would prevent biological males from competing on girls' sports teams or biological females from competing on boys' sports teams.
Right.
It's become a real issue across the country. We're seeing men who identify as women getting into women's sports and dominating complete sports. Yeah. So you see that swimmer in Pennsylvania doing that, and this happened elsewhere. Tell us a little bit about your, say, Women's Sports Act for Kentucky.
Yeah, so real quickly, it just requires the Kentucky High School Athletic Association to label sports boys, co-ed, or girls. And it does not allow boys to actually compete in a girls' sport. And it doesn't address hormone therapy. It doesn't address how long they've been under therapy and things of that nature. It just says, if you're a biological male, you cannot compete in women's sports, just plain and simple.
And that's only through K, I'm sorry to interrupt, so only through K through 12.
K through 12, yeah. It does not address the more difficult part of this subject, which is NCAA college sports. And, you know, when we start talking about that, then the NCAA is a very liberal organization, and the University of Kentucky, University of Louisville, our other regional colleges are all concerned about what NCAA would do if the state of Kentucky had, banned transgender athletes. So I think that, to be honest with you, I think that's going to work its way out here over the next year or so. But I'm really more concerned about the young lady that's a very good athlete. She's 13 or 14 years old, and all of a sudden she is competing against a male and being beat after she's really worked hard to be on that team or on that group, and it's just not fair. You know, it really pushes and makes women's sports fall back, you know, many, many years. There's been a lot of attempts to allow women to have equal opportunity in sports, and something like this really sets them back quite a bit.
So, Robbie, because of fairness, because you care about maintaining women's sports and giving opportunities to young girls who want to compete against other young girls, you are proposing this. Again, I want to reemphasize something I said before, because often when you have legislation like this, you're accused of being cold-hearted or you don't like certain groups of people, but that's really not the motivation here.
It's not. It's just, we want young ladies to have opportunities in high school, and we don't think it's fair for a male to do some hormone therapy and then all of a sudden be able to run a 400-yard dash against a young lady. And that is happening around the country. That will continue to happen because, once again, like I said earlier, this is a fad, and this is something that it's kind of a tsunami or a wave that you see coming.
Very good. Robbie, that was the timer. That means our time is up.
Ready to go.
I've enjoyed this. This has been a good program.
Yes, sir.
Best to you this legislative session. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Richard.